Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome along on this brisk and invigorating Melbourne winter. It's delightful to see you here and to hear about a most important country. It's one that's been a bit neglected in the past, I believe, in terms of Australia's understanding of the important relationships that we should have with this country. It's certainly going to be one of the major economies. It is already one of the major economies, not only in its region of the world, but all over the world, and it's going to get even bigger as time goes on. The lecture tonight is, well, the discussion tonight is around the theme of it's time to get serious about India. And I agree with that absolutely. And we're particularly lucky that we've got Dr. Pradeep Taneja, who's a lecturer in Asian politics in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne, where he is also a fellow of the Australian India Institute and convener of a task force on Sino-Indian relations. We've had the difficulties of these relationships between our two countries brought to the fore, and particularly in this year, in relation to students in particular in Australia. And I'm quite sure that Dr. Taneja will have something to say about these issues as well, because he's a very broadly educated man. He's been educated in India, China, and Australia. He probably speaks about 15 languages, I don't know, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if he does. I only speak two, English and profane.
I'll speak to you in
these notes here are rather good. They say he's an astute observer, and I'm sure he is, of the political and economic developments in Asia for the past 25 years. Ladies and gentlemen, to bring us up to date and to help us get serious about India, would you please welcome Dr. Taneja.
Well, I'm surprised to see so many of you here today. I wasn't expecting that many people. I thought we'll have a nice, cozy, comfortable discussion. So it's good to have so many of you here today. India, of course, is a country I was born in. Although professionally I make my living by teaching about China. My position at the University of Melbourne is largely teaching Chinese politics and China's international relations. But as India emerges from the wilderness, there is a great deal of interest in India. And the University of Melbourne last year established a Australia-India Institute, which I'm part of. And after being headless for nearly a year and a half, the Institute now has a new director who has arrived from India. There was a worldwide search for a new director, and the new director, Professor Amitabh Natu, has arrived about 6 weeks ago, and I'm hoping that one day we can bring him here to talk about India. He's a Kashmiri Indian. He's from Kashmir, and Kashmir, as you know, is one of the most challenging environments as far as international politics is concerned, and he has a very deep knowledge of that part of the subcontinent, and hopefully, you know, in the not too distant future, we can get him to come and talk about Kashmir here. Now, I'm also at that age where I need glasses. So, now, I was roped into talk here by Tony Ferrison there. We were chatting about China, and somehow over a cup of coffee in the Graduate House at the University of Melbourne, the discussion turned to the Australia-India relations, which I also closely follow. And Tony said, you must come and talk about Australia's relations with India. So here I am. The relationship between India and Australia, of course, though old, has been through some rough patches in the past couple of years. And a reference was made to the troubles we had in 2009 and early 2010 in relation to the Indian students in Australia. The relationship, of course, goes back to the 19th century, if not earlier. The Indian High Commissioner to Australia, is fond of saying that by 1840s, a ship was sailing from Sydney for India every 4 days. So the connection between India and Australia in the colonial period was quite strong, and particularly after the colony of New South Wales was established, Calcutta, the then capital of the British India or East India Company base, was a major source of supply of food to New South Wales. And that's why there was such a large traffic between India and Australia. But since independence, the relationship between India and Australia has been that of benign neglect. In other words, India was there. It was a country with which Australia had reasonably good relations, but there was not a lot to do with India after independence of India in 1947. And historians have, of course, written about the relationship between Bob Menzies and Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India. And Jawaharlal Nehru and Menzies did not get along very well. They often met at the Commonwealth Heads of Governments meeting, the Chogham meetings. And Nehru, of course, was a British educated at Harrow and Cambridge, very highly polished Englishman of India. Menzies, of course, was son of the soil, but of course very loyal to the crown. But Nehru was also a strong nationalist, and therefore the two did not get along very well. And that affected the relationship between India and Australia for a long time. Now, coming back to the troubles we had between Australia and India, and particularly the student issue in 2009, the media in both India and Australia played their part in playing up the differences or the problems that occurred in 2009. But it is true to say that 2009-2010, that period of about a year, was particularly tough year for Australia India relations. It was in many ways a crisis for Australia's relations with India. But as somebody said not too long ago, that you should never allow a good crisis to go to waste. And I think Australia did exactly that. In 2009, we saw a flurry of activity between Australia and India. There was a series of ministers from Australia who went to India to repair the damage. The Indian foreign minister also came to Australia. And so as a result, we saw that although the media in both countries played up this problem, at a government-to-government relations level, the relationship did not suffer as much as it potentially could have. Julia Gillard, as the Minister of Education and Deputy Prime Minister, went to India in 2009. John Brumby, the then Premier of Victoria, also went to India. And of course, then later that year, we saw Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister also visit India. So at the government-to-government level, the relationship did not suffer as much as it potentially could have. But I shall return to the issue of these attacks on Indian students a little later. But let me first look at some of the similarities and differences between Australia and India. Of course, the most common cliche is that Australia and India share 3 C's. And the 3 C's are cricket, curry, and Commonwealth. And I put it in that order, although some people tend to put the Commonwealth first, because I think the Commonwealth doesn't really figure as prominently in the people's minds. And therefore, cricket, of course, is very important to both countries. And after cricket, I think a good Indian curry is always very popular with the Australian population. And then Commonwealth. This, of course, as I said, is a cliche, of course. The relationship is much more diverse. It has many things other than just cricket, curry, and Commonwealth. There are other things in common. For example, both India and Australia are federal democracies, and sometimes quite raucous democracies. Indian democracy, of course, is well known to be particularly raucous, I think only after Taiwan. Taiwanese parliament tends to be very raucous, and Indian parliament is not too shy either. India and Australia also have a very noisy media, particularly India, because when I was growing up in India, you only had one television channel. That was state-run Doordarshan channel. And it was very boring. because every time you turned on the news, the news was about the Prime Minister inaugurating this, Prime Minister inaugurating that. So it was essentially an inauguration bulletin rather than a real news bulletin. But then Rupert Murdoch decided to buy a television, a satellite television channel called Star TV, which was established by a Hong Kong billionaire, Lee Ka-shing's son. It wasn't doing terribly well under Lee Ka-shing and family, but Rupert Murdoch turned it around. It became a very big commercial success. And initially, of course, Rupert Murdoch assumed that China would be the big market. But as soon as Rupert Murdoch bought Star TV and made a few comments about the potential or the democratizing potential of Star TV, the Chinese government decided to ban satellite dishes. And that was the end. That was the end of the Star TV success in China. Since then, of course, he's done a lot to repair the damage. But the great success story of Star TV has been India. In India, Star TV, with multiple channels now, has been a big hit. And probably the only country in which Star TV, I think, makes a profit. But with Star TV, of course, came a series of new commercial television channels. Now in India, every time I go to India, I'm surprised to find new channels. Every time, and I do travel to India almost every 3 months, and I find every time I turn on the TV, there is a new channel with 24-hour news. So in 2009, when the attacks on Indian students were being reported, India's 24-7 news channels. You know, in Australia, we've got two. We've got Sky News on cable, and we now have Australia 24, ABC 24. In India, you have more than 24-hour news channels, and they need something to report. So in 2009, when the attacks on Indian students were being reported, this was a great story for them. I remember checking into a hotel at about 11 o'clock in the evening in Bangalore in 2009. And having checked in, I ordered some room service, and I went to bed at 2 o'clock. Between 11 and 12, most of these news channels were reporting stories of attacks on Indian students in Melbourne, continuously. So you can imagine the headache for the Australian High Commissioner in India, because this was a huge story. And the Indian High Commission, sorry, the Australian High Commission in Delhi had to manage that story. The Indian High Commissioner in Canberra also did not have an easy time. And particularly the Indian Consul General in Melbourne, who has spoken at the Institute, had a great difficulty because the government in Delhi was asking them to do something about it, but there was very little that the diplomats could do to deal with the situation. Now, having said that there are a lot of similarities between Australia and India, there are, of course, also differences. India is an ancient society steeped in religion and mystical beliefs. Anybody who's been to India would see that India is a very complex society. It is often said that everything that is true about India, the opposite is also true. And particularly the diversity of religions, castes, you know, and other ethnic and cultural backgrounds that you see in India make it much more difficult for an outsider to try to understand India. Even Indians have to struggle to try and make sense of their own country. But particularly foreigners find it very difficult to try and come to terms with a country like India. Traditions, rituals, and ceremonies play an important part in Indian life. They are something which Indians take for granted, but most foreigners find it very difficult to comprehend. Indians are also sensitive to social status, but at the same time are alert to discrimination based on skin color. And this is why the attacks on Indian students in 2010 had such a strong sort of resonance in India. Indians are very individualistic. Unlike many other Asian countries, Indians tend to be very individualistic, while paradoxically also being tolerant of social hierarchies. India is a very hierarchical society. Some of you who would be familiar with India's, you know, caste system, for example, would be aware of the hierarchy of caste. But there are all kinds of hierarchies in India. So while Indians tend to be personally and in their professional careers quite individualistic, but at the same time they are also tolerant of social hierarchies. Indian culture teaches respect for elders and those in positions of power. That doesn't mean that the Indians will tolerate their politicians even if they are corrupt. As you probably have noticed in the Indian media, and it's been reported in the Australian media, there has been a series of corruption scams, as they're called in India. And Indian public has been up in arms, you know, about corruption. But at the same time, if somebody is in a position of power, position of influence, generally there is a social respect for that individual. And this is why this reminds me of the 2006 cricket trip that Australian team made to India, particularly the conclusion of the Champions Trophy, which Australia won. But at the closing ceremony, after the victory of Australia in the finals of the Champions Trophy, when the president of the Board of Cricket Control in India, who was also a senior minister of the Indian government, came to hand over the trophy to the Australian captain and invited the Australian captain to come to the stage, Ricky Ponting, of course, pointed to his team and asked them all to join him on the stage. And the minister who was then 66 years old and walked very slowly, was waiting to hand over the trophy to Ricky Ponting. Ricky Ponting pointed to him and asked him to hurry up. And then Daniel Martin, a member of the Australian cricket team, pushed him off the stage, gently, but pushed him off the stage. And the Indian media was up in arms about the boorishness of Australian cricketers. And they said Australians lack culture. And that, of course, was, again, something which affected the perception of Australia in Indian minds, that a ceremony of that nature is very important in India. And rather than receiving the trophy and showing respect for the person who is handing over the trophy, he was pushed off the stage by the Indian team. And there's still a YouTube, you know, you can go to YouTube and watch it. And Indian media was up in arms, and eventually Ricky Ponting himself apologized to the minister, and who was also the chairman of the cricket board, and the Cricket Australia also offered an apology to the Indian public. So these things, while they may not appear important to sports people, but they can do a lot of damage to the reputation of a country when we are dealing with sensitive international relations. Now, the context of relations between Australia and India has been changing, and changing fairly rapidly, particularly over the last 20 years. After more than a decade of high-speed economic growth, rising living standards and improving infrastructure, the people of India feel much more confident about themselves and their country's future. Now, we all know the progress that China has made over the past 30 years. And the Australian media, of course, devotes much more space to developments in China than it does to India. And the general Australian public, I think, is much more aware of what's happening in China than it is about India. But India too, particularly since 1991, when India began its own version of open door policy, changes have been quite dramatic. And as I said, although I travel to India at least, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, but every time I go to India, I see change. The cities look different. Sometimes it's difficult to find places that you knew because there's been so much new construction. Of course, the changes in India pale into insignificance compared to changes in places like Shenzhen in China or Shanghai for that matter. But at the same time, by Indian standards, the changes have been quite radical. India's standing in the international community has risen. 4 of the 5 permanent members of the United Nations Security Council have now endorsed India's desire, India's bid, to be accepted as a permanent member of the Security Council. China is the only exception. Of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, China is the only country which has not yet openly supported India's position. China has a very standard sort of phrase that the Chinese officials tend to repeat. The Chinese official position is that China appreciates and understands India's desire to play a greater role in international affairs, including in the United Nations. Full stop. You know? But China doesn't go the extra step that Barack Obama did when he visited India. Addressing the joint session of the Indian Parliament, Barack Obama openly declared that he would like to see India take its place as a permanent member of the Security Council. Of course, Britain, France and Russia had already done that. Now China is the only other country which has yet to accept that particular position. Today, India's relations with all the major countries of the world are stronger and focused on strengthening India's relative position in the world. India, having been pilloried at times as being the sick man of Asia, particularly as East Asian economies were growing rapidly, India was seen as growing at this so-called Hindu rate of growth. And as you probably know, between 1940s and 1980s, Indian economy, 1970s, Indian economy grew at an average annual rate of 3.5%, which by the standards of East Asia was very low. And it was an Indian economist who actually used the term, the so-called Hindu rate of growth. But then the rest of the Western media also picked up on that, and Indian growth story was always reported as lagging behind the rest of Asia. But since India began its economic reforms in 1991, we have seen India's growth rate picked up, and particularly over the last past 10 years, India's economy has grown at an average annual rate of about 8.3%. So for India, that is a remarkable turnaround. And when a country the size of India grows at 8.5 or 9%, that's a huge change, not only for the business community in the country, but for the general population. Hundreds of millions of people in India have been lifted out of poverty because of this higher rate of growth. That doesn't mean that there aren't any problems. In fact, in many ways, the higher rate of growth has aggravated some of the social tensions in India. For example, in parts of India which are rich in natural resources, it is becoming harder to extract those resources because of tribal and other sensibilities. You probably heard of the Maoist movement. The Maoists may be out of favor in China, but there is still a strong Maoist insurgency in various parts of India. The Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, in fact, has described the Maoist insurgency as the greatest internal security threat to India. So the widening income gap has also aggravated some of the pre-existing tensions and stresses in Indian society. More importantly, the Indian foreign policy is no longer driven by ideology. As you know, India was one of the founders of the non-alignment movement and one of the champions of non-alignment, and therefore Indian foreign policy in the past was driven by this ideology of non-alignment and particularly suspicion of the West and suspicion of capitalism. Indian foreign policy is now very much focused on advancing India's national interest rather than on any ideology. India is much more closely integrated with the world economy than it has ever been. As you can already tell by the Indian companies who are now playing an important part, those of you who drive a Jaguar probably don't know the Jaguar is a company, a brand which is now owned by an Indian company, Tata. If you drink Tetley tea is also owned by an Indian company called Tata. So the world's largest steel producer is a company owned by an Indian, Lakshmi Mittal. So Indian companies are now playing an important part in the world economy, and at the same time, India is open to business. It doesn't mean that India is an easy market. It's not. India is still, you talk to any business person, and you will know that India is a difficult market still to enter. Partly because of some of the barriers that still exist to the entry of foreign goods, but also partly because Indian companies themselves are very competitive. So for any foreign company to succeed in India, they have to be able to compete with Indian companies. And many of these Indian companies have gone through some tough times and have become very competitive as a result. And most significantly, there is a sense of rivalry with China. And this has been a major driver of India's own economic progress. So when I talk about the rivalry with China, it does not necessarily mean it's a negative rivalry. It is a much more positive rivalry in the sense that China's development has awakened India to its own potential and the dangers of being left behind. So in India now there's an awareness that unless India gets its act together, it will be left behind by China, and that will not be good for India's security or for the well-being of the Indian population. And therefore, I've been told by officials, for example, in India, that when bureaucrats in a government ministry put together a proposal, a brief, take it to the minister, and if the minister rejects it, they often remind them that China is doing exactly the same. And then the position changes. That if China is doing it, we better watch it closely. And maybe there's something in it. Maybe we should do it too. So China has become a kind of a foil to India. And the rivalry with China is really a socially constructed rivalry. It's a rivalry which has been deliberately cultivated by the Indian media, by the Indian intellectuals, to goad the Indian government into becoming more efficient, into getting things done so that India can progress, because otherwise the dangers of China leaping ahead of India would be much more serious, or potentially much more serious. Now, I'm mindful of the time, so I'll continue. Now I want to focus briefly on some of the bright spots in Australia-India relations. Because of the attacks on Indian students in 2009, so much of the focus was on the negatives. The reality is that there are quite a few bright spots in Australia-India relations. If you focus, for example, on the economic relationship, particularly bilateral trade, it has been growing very rapidly. India, in fact, is one of the fastest growing markets for Australian exports. According to Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade figures, India was Australia's fourth largest merchandise export market and the fifth largest merchandise trading partner in 2010. I think most Australians don't realize this, that India was the fourth largest merchandise export market for Australia. And you'll be surprised to see the makeup of Australian exports. Take a guess. What's Australia's biggest export to India?
Wool.
Wool?
Iron ore.
No, iron ore is one commodity in which India and Australia are competitors.
Yeah.
India actually also exports iron ore, and therefore it's a competitor of Australia.
Gold?
Gold, exactly. Gold is the single largest Australian export to India. Indians love their gold, and they love their 22, 24 carat jewelry. Nothing like a 9 carat jewelry. And I personally, I think most Indians living in Australia have a problem. If they want to buy jewelry as a gift for somebody in India, it's hard to find a piece of gold jewelry bought in Australia that they would like, because they look at the color of the gold. If it's not bright yellow, it's not gold. And that's why Australia has been such a major sort of exporter of gold to India. Now also, Australian foreign direct investment in India has been growing very rapidly. There is roughly, according to Australian government figures, nearly $3 billion in investments by Australians in India. But unfortunately, the bulk of this investment is portfolio investment. In other words, Australian financial institutions or Australian investors investing in Indian companies on the stock market rather than foreign direct investment. Because foreign direct investment is much more useful when it comes to improving relations, because foreign direct investment means Australian people actually being in India and working in India, working with Indian people, and therefore it helps in developing the relationship further. But Australia's foreign direct investment in India is only about $218 million. So a paltry sum compared to Australia's investment in some other parts of the world, particularly in Britain and the United States. On trade, again, the two governments agreed a number of years ago to conduct a joint feasibility study on a free trade agreement. This study was concluded about, I think, 18 months ago, and negotiations on a free trade agreement are yet to start. But I think, personally, that reaching a free trade agreement between Australia and India is going to be quite difficult, because Australia's exports, other than commodities which a country has to buy, there is no choice. So, for example, if India buys gold, it is going to buy gold from whoever is willing to supply it. Coking coal, again, the same story. But when it comes to agricultural exports, Indian market is still quite protected. And in any free trade agreement with India, Australia would be seeking to open up India's agricultural market. And that, in my view, is going to be quite challenging. So I'm not holding any hopes of a quick signing of a free trade agreement between India and Australia. And if there is an agreement reached in the next few years, I think it will only be a partial free trade agreement rather than a full free trade agreement. There are, of course, Australian companies in India. There are Indian companies in Australia. For example, most of the major Indian software companies now have a presence in India. And some of these companies employ hundreds of Australians, particularly in Melbourne. At the strategic level, also, the relationship is growing, rapidly, but steadily. The two countries decided in 2009 to upgrade their relationship to a strategic partnership. So now Australia and India have agreed to build a strategic partnership. What it actually means in reality is yet to be seen, but there was a joint declaration on security cooperation which was signed in 2009 during Kevin Rudd's visit to India as Prime Minister. And importantly, this particular declaration was based on, and I quote here, quote, a shared desire to promote regional and global security, as well as their common commitment to democracy, freedom, human rights, and the rule of law, unquote. These are the values which are common between Australia and India. And any relationship, any sustainable relationship between these two countries will have to be based on an acceptance of these common values. Because any relationship which is purely based on short-term commercial interest is not going to be a very strong relationship. And that's why I was glad to see that these values were emphasized in this joint declaration. Mind you, this joint declaration itself was based on a similar declaration that Australia signed with Japan in 2007 when John Howard was Prime Minister. So if you look at the text of this declaration, it is very similar to the 2007 Australia-Japan declaration. At the security level in India, there is some concern that Australia is not too keen to develop a proper security relationship with India, despite the joint declaration. That Australia is too cautious. Australia is too worried about China's reaction to developing a strategic relationship with India. Because in China, any relationship between the United States and its allies or other friendly powers is seen as part of an attempt to contain China. And in China, the 2007 declaration between Australia and Japan was heavily criticized in China because the Chinese portrayed it as an attempt to try and contain China. And therefore, particularly since 2007, when the Labour government came to power, in India there has been a concern that Australia is too sensitive to China's reaction. So let me now turn to some of the more outstanding issues or the challenges in Australia-India relationship. The violent attacks on Indian students in Australia have had a serious impact on the Indian public's perception of Australia. As I said, the media in both India and Australia did not help, and particularly in India. But overall, tens of thousands of Indian families who had children studying in Australia, who had sons and daughters studying in Australia, and their extended families were genuinely concerned about the situation in this country. I personally, although I've been living in Australia for 26 years, I had friends in India sending emails to me and asking about the situation in Australia. I remember one of my trips to India, as I was returning from Delhi, on a flight from Delhi to Singapore and then on to Melbourne, the security people, the police people who look at your bags, they asked me, how's the situation in Australia? I had friends writing emails to me and saying that we hear Australia is in flames. So you can see the perception that was created by the media coverage of the attacks on Indian students here. And that has certainly affected the perception of Australia and Australians in the minds of the Indian public. And the initial attempts by the Australian government, both the federal government and the Victorian government, to deny that there might have been a racist dimension to these attacks, played into the hands of the Indian media hungry for headlines. Now, initially, there was an attempt on the part of the government to say that no, there was no racism. And I remember advising people from the Victorian government and then Victoria Police that they should not jump to conclusion and say there is no racist element. Instead of that, if they had said that, look, Australia has very strict laws against, you know, racial attacks or racist violence, and if these attacks are found to be racist, then action will be taken. Rather than saying that, the attempts to simply deny at the beginning, without any investigation, that there might have been a racist element to these attacks, did not go down very well in India and with the Indian public. Many in India see the marketing, and now I turn to the attempts by the Australian universities and higher educational institutions and vocational educational institutions to try and recruit more students in India. In India, particularly since these attacks, many people see these marketing efforts of Australian educational institutions as a greedy attempt to exploit Indian middle-class families without offering any meaningful support services for international students or providing protection from these attacks. So, in India, of course, there are numerous agents who represent Australian educational institutions. So it is very rare that Indian students actually come face to face with, you know, people from Australian higher educational institutions. But the advertising and marketing by educational institutions is sometimes seen as being a greedy attempt to simply make money. Indian academics tend to be even more critical. I've heard Indian academics describe marketing by Australian universities in India as body shopping. Right? And as attacks were occurring in India, and there were a few fatal attacks, it literally became body shopping. That these students would come to Australia and they would die because of the violence. And of course, those of us living in Australia knew that the extent of this problem was not as big. But the portrayal of the violence was, of course, very serious, and it had a significant impact on the image of Australia in India. The urgent steps taken by the federal government and the Victorian government were successful in ensuring that there was no long-term damage to government-to-government relations. So at the government-to-government level, as I said at the beginning, the damage was controlled by the steps taken by both the federal and the state government. But at the general public level, the damage to Australia's image was serious, and it will still take a long time to repair it. Also, there is a nagging feeling in India that Australia does not want to see India emerge as a great power. And this you will see from Indian strategic affairs analysts and international affairs commentators who feel that Australia is too pro-China, and that it is too afraid of China, and therefore it is unwilling to engage India comprehensively, and that's because Australia is somehow not keen to see India emerge as a great power. Now, as I said, the reality may be quite different, but at least that is the perception in India. They feel that Australia acts in a manner that is inimical to India's interests. And this was, of course, first fueled by Australia's unwillingness to allow India to join AIPAC. If you remember, Australia until very late in the piece, when Australia itself hosted the APEC summit in Sydney, when John Howard came out in support of India's membership of APEC. Australia had up to that point been against India joining APEC. And that was seen as an attempt by Australia to keep India out of multilateral organizations that promote regional integration. Then the refusal, or rather reversal, of the Howard government policy to sell uranium to India contributes to that feeling too. Australia's decision to support the nuclear suppliers group waiver for India, but then to refuse to sell uranium to India, is seen in India as contradictory. Some of you may be familiar with this particular document. India and the United States, under the former President George Bush, reached a civil nuclear cooperation agreement under which India would be allowed to access nuclear energy, technology, and nuclear energy materials, uranium in particular, without having to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And this agreement was then approved by the International Atomic Energy Agency and, more significantly, by the Nuclear Suppliers Group. And Australia's position at the Nuclear Suppliers Group, of which Australia is a member, was to support a waiver to be given to India. But then, having supported a waiver for India, for Australia to say, no, we can't sell uranium to you because you're not a member of the NPT or signatory to the NPT, is seen in India as contradictory. If Australia was opposed to India having access to uranium, then India should not have supported the NSG waiver. But of course, the NSG waiver was initiated by the United States, and Australia's refusal to support it would have affected Australia's relations with the US, and therefore Australia's position was to support the waiver, but Australia has not been willing to accept the terms of the agreement that India reached with the United States, and in India, of course, there is a great deal of criticism of that. Australia's refusal to sell uranium to India, while readily selling it to China, a known proliferator of nuclear weapons technology, infuriates India's political and intellectual elite. We all know that Australia, since 2006, has been selling uranium to China. Now, India's position has been that India is willing to reach the same kinds of safeguards that Australia negotiated and reached with China. But Australia's position is that Australia's uranium export policy says that Australia will not export uranium to countries which are not signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And therefore, Australia is sticking to that position and not agreeing to sell uranium to India. Now, so where do we go from here? There is clearly, at the government-to-government level, there is a problem that the Indian government feels that Australia has a discriminatory attitude towards India. At the public level, there is a perception that Australia, that is, in India, there is a perception that Australia acts against India's interests, that Australia would not want to see India emerge as a great power. So where do we go from here in terms of what's the way forward? Personally, I have a few recommendations to make here. I think Australia needs to send a clear signal to India that it is willing to fully support the progress that India has made in reaching civil nuclear energy and defense cooperation agreements with the United States. All other major powers, Russia, France, and Britain, have agreed to engage in nuclear commerce with India. And remember, we are not talking about nuclear weapons. We are talking about nuclear power stations. And particularly this agreement that India has reached with the United States would separate India's nuclear weapons program from its nuclear energy program. Also, India has agreed to put two-thirds of India's nuclear reactors under inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which China hasn't. China already has accepted some voluntary inspections, but not full inspections. And China can withdraw those voluntary inspection agreements anytime it likes. So Australia needs to send a clear signal that it is willing to support those agreements that India has reached with other major powers. Now, the Resources Minister, Martin Ferguson, has supported making changes in Australia's uranium export policy to allow exports to India. Now, I believe that the Prime Minister needs to offer her personal support, even if actual change in policy may take some time. Now, we know that Greg Sheridan and some other journalists have talked about the next Labour conference will probably overturn this policy. I'm not so sure. But I think Julia Gillard needs to make her position clear, her personal position clear, just as Martin Ferguson has done, and say that she's personally in favour of selling uranium to India, subject to the usual safeguards, and subject to persuading her party, the Labour Party, to change its policy and its attitude. I also believe that Australia should not be overly cautious about China's reactions to its efforts to develop stronger strategic ties with India. You might remember, or some of you might remember, that when Shinzo Abe was Prime Minister of Japan, he proposed a quadrilateral initiative, an initiative in which United States, Australia, Japan, and India will meet once a year and talk about their common security interests. Howard government had quietly accepted that proposal. The Rudd government decided to pull out of that. So we still have Japan, Australia, US trilateral, but it does not include India. And I think that reaction from the Rudd government was largely because of the fear of either a reaction or a reprisal from China. I don't think Australia should be overly cautious about China's reaction on this particular issue. As two Indian Ocean powers, Australia and India should be able to develop a mutually supportive defense and security relationship without looking over their shoulders. And finally, Australia and India should give high priority to an early bilateral visit to Australia by the Prime Minister of India. You may be surprised to know that no Indian Prime Minister has visited Australia in 26 years. We have not had a prime ministerial visit from India for 26 years. You cannot have a normal, thriving relationship without bilateral visits. And no Indian Prime Minister has felt it necessary to visit this country. We know that Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has accepted the invitation to attend the CHOGAM meeting in Perth later this year. But there is still no agreement on a bilateral visit. And I think the uranium issue is a stumbling block. If the Prime Minister of India comes on a bilateral visit to Australia, he would expect some achievements. Prime Ministers usually don't go unless they get something out of a visit. And particularly if a visit is coming after 26 years, the Prime Minister of India would want to be able to return home with something concrete in hand. And I know that the Australian government is trying to get him to travel to Canberra for a bilateral visit from Perth, but it's probably not going to happen. Personally, I feel that even if it doesn't happen this time, that is, later this year, I feel that that Australia and India should work together to try and arrange a bilateral visit by the Prime Minister of India to Australia. And when he does visit Australia, he should be invited to address a joint session of the Australian Parliament. Remember, an unelected President of China has addressed the Australian Parliament. But the leader of the largest democracy in the world has not had this opportunity. And therefore, I think if Manmohan Singh or any other Indian Prime Minister comes to Australia, he or she should be invited to address a joint session of the Australian Parliament. There can be no stronger signal to the Indian public of the importance Australia attaches to its relations with India than an address to the Australian Parliament by an elected Prime Minister of India. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, when somebody's so enthusiastic about the subject that they're speaking on, and we've heard such a speaker tonight. You'll forgive me if I didn't say time's getting on a little bit here. So we do have some time for questions, and let's see how they go. Yes, down the back.
On current projections, the population of India will overtake the population of China in the not too distant future. Is in India, is that seen as a good thing or not so good thing?
Well, in India, the population growth in India, the growth rate has slowed down. As the Indian economy has grown, population growth rate has slowed down. So as the demographers say, there's a direct correlation between economic growth and living standards and population growth. And that seems to be happening in India. But at the moment, economists and demographers tell us that the fact that India did not control its population as strictly as China did has actually paid a dividend for India, because India has a much younger population than China. I don't have the exact figures with me, but I have a slide which I usually show at lectures and seminars, which shows the aging of China's population compared to the younger demographic of India. And particularly for economic growth, particularly the future economic growth, a younger population is more of an asset than an aging population. But the Indian government is conscious of the need to curb population growth, particularly as much of the population growth is occurring in lower socioeconomic strata. So most of the middle class people I know in India, for example, most of my generation have no more than two children. Whereas when you go into the poorer parts of Bombay or Delhi, you find families having seven or eight kids. And that clearly is something which is not sustainable for them as families and for the country as a whole.
Yes.
What's the current state of relations with Pakistan? Big subject, I know.
A big subject, a totally different topic, I think, for discussion. But you would be pleased to know that they have resumed dialogue. Recently, the Foreign Secretary of India visited Pakistan, and because you might may or may not know that after the Mumbai attacks, the attacks on the hotels in Mumbai, some of you may have stayed at the Taj Hotel in Mumbai and would know that in 2008, Pakistan-based terrorists attacked the city of Mumbai and nearly 180 people were killed in that attack. And after that attack, the Indian government decided to cancel all negotiations, official discussions with Pakistan. And just last month, the two governments have agreed to resume dialogue. So that's happy news. Yep.
Hi, I was just wondering how you thought the relationships between India and China would develop as they both try to compete for dominance in the international stage in the future.
How they will develop?
Or, I guess, will there be a positive relationship between the future
The China-India relationship is a complex one. It's been developing very rapidly. You'll be surprised to know that China is India's largest trading partner. Something that 10 years ago would have been inconceivable. The two-way trade between China and India is nearly $60 billion a year. Much larger than Australia-India trade. So the economic relationship between China and India has been growing very well. And the leaders of both countries are very happy with the progress as far as the economic relationship is concerned. But the critical issue is the boundary dispute between China and India. And even after 30 years of negotiations, there is no resolution to that problem in sight. And personally, my view is, which differs from many of my other China experts in India, colleagues who specialize on China and India, many of them believe that the border dispute would be resolved by itself. Let's focus on developing relationship in other areas. Personally, my view is, which I've repeated in India many times, that they need to redouble their efforts to try and resolve the boundary dispute, because we cannot really have Asia's two largest powers having a festering sore in the form of this boundary dispute, because it can trigger potentially a conflict between these two nuclear armed and two very large Asian powers, and it cannot be very good for the future prosperity of Asia. And therefore it's important that China and India take their boundary dispute seriously. The position of Deng Xiaoping was that this is a historical, it's a dispute which has been left over to us by history, and maybe the future generation would be wiser, we leave it to them. I don't think it'll be fair on the future generations to have to deal with this problem. I think they need to address this problem and address it quickly.
Thanks, Doctor. I got the impression from your talk that you think that Australia understands that India would really like to have uranium shipped from Australia, and doing so without signing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What, in your understanding, is the Indian perception of what Australia would like from India? You know, because that, I don't think you really addressed that. I might have missed it, but.
In terms of uranium exports?
Well, no, in terms of, you know, if this is a significant interest of India's, and they're trying to reach some sort of agreement to achieve that objective, what are they understanding Australia really wants from India? You mentioned the free trade agreement, indicated that's not likely to happen. But surely India must be looking to Australia and thinking, okay, what is Australia really wants?
Australia has not stated any. I mean, obviously, Australia would like to see a free trade agreement with India, because free trade agreement, particularly if it includes agriculture, could be quite beneficial. And already, if you look at the balance of trade between Australia and India, it is heavily in Australia's favour. So Indian imports are only a fraction. Sorry, Indian imports into Australia are only a fraction of Australian exports to India. So in terms of balance of trade, the balance of trade is very much in Australia's favour. And in India, there's a feeling that a free trade agreement may actually worsen that situation. That is, if there is a free trade agreement, then it will favour Australia, you know, and therefore the balance of trade will, you know, change much more heavily in Australia's favour. Australia hasn't really, apart from the free trade agreement, Australia hasn't expressed any particular demand on Australia. Of course, as far as exporting uranium to India is concerned, Australia would like India to sign the NPT, which of course is not going to happen, because India signing the NPT in its present form would mean India will have to give up its nuclear weapons. Right? And I think these demands, they don't fully appreciate the security environment in which India operates. When in 1998 the Indian government decided to go ahead and test a nuclear weapon in May 1998, in a letter to the American president, the Prime Minister of India referred not to Pakistan but to China as the reason why India was developing or was going nuclear. Because you probably know that India first tested a nuclear device in 1974. Then between 1974 and 1998, India did not test. In 1998, India decided to test, because China has been a nuclear weapon state since 1964. And in 1962, China and India fought a war. They have a border dispute that has not been resolved. And the power gap between China and India has been increasing. And therefore, the security environment for India was deteriorating. And in Australia, particularly amongst people who are proponents of nuclear disarmament, who would like India to sign the NPT, there is not a sufficient understanding of the security environment which India, you know, faces. In India, often India's more hawkish international affairs analysts often describe such people as the non-proliferation Ayatollahs. That is, they take a puritanical view of, you know, non-proliferation without appreciating the security environment that every country faces. And in India's case, of course, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and that was proven 2 weeks after India's nuclear test in 1998, because 2 weeks after India's test, Pakistan conducted its own tests, which proved that Pakistan already had the nuclear weapon. And China, of course, has been a nuclear power, you know, public nuclear power since 1964. So Australia, apart from demanding that that India sign NPT if it wants to have access to Australian uranium, hasn't made any particular demand of India. I mean, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, go if you like.
Is it true to say the caste system is breaking down in India? And if so, sort of at what rate?
Well, the caste system is something which is both breaking down, yes, but also no. in certain areas. In the urban areas, in industrial complexes, it has already broken down. For example, my father used to work for the railways, and I grew up in a railway township. And in the railway township, everybody, regardless of their caste, lived next to each other, because everybody lived in the accommodation provided to them by the railways. Right? You worked together as children. We ate at each other's home without even knowing what their caste was. So industrialization has been a great leveler when it comes to the caste system. But in politics in India, even though discrimination based on caste is illegal under the Indian constitution, and there are severe penalties for that, in India, when it comes to elections, every general election in India, caste becomes, or political calculations based on caste become paramount. Because as part of India's affirmative action policy, there are seats reserved. There's a large number of seats in parliament reserved for people belonging to the lower castes. That is, only candidates belonging to those castes can contest elections from those seats. And voters, regardless of their caste, have no choice but to vote for one of the lower caste candidates, because there is no upper caste candidate from that constituency. It's a good thing. It ensures a strong representation of the lower caste in the Indian parliament. But at the same time, the reservation policy has meant that caste consciousness has become very strong. And even politicians who are opposed to discrimination based on caste, which apparently they all are, even they make calculations based on which area has which caste. So this area has a higher proportion of Brahmins, this area, this constituency has a larger proportion of the Dalits, so-called untouchables. And therefore, while the affirmative action policy has been good in increasing representation of lower castes in the parliament, at the same time, it has made it very difficult to remove this, you know, caste-based politics from India. So, for example, the last time a census was taken in which a question was asked about your caste was in 1931, still under the British administration. Since independence, since 1947, India has a census every 10 years. The question of caste has not been asked since 1931. So all the data in India on various castes, you know, what proportion of India's population is what caste, has been based on extrapolation from 1931 census. And this has led to people asking that perhaps we should know exactly how many people belong to which caste. So for the first time, this year, the Indian government has decided that at this census, the latest census, a question would be asked about caste.
Can I take the chairman's prerogative at this stage, seeing as we're coming to the end of the evening, and I'll get to you. Just on this caste, who decides which caste you are and how do you display it, and can you move from one caste to another?
And can I ask, continuing that very question, I'm sorry to be so ignorant, but what is the basis?
Of the various castes. There are essentially, for those of you who are not familiar with the caste system, and I'm not an anthropologist, and therefore I'm not an expert in this area, but there are four broad varnas, as they're called in Sanskrit, four major castes. There are thousands of castes in India, but there are four broad varnas, as they're called. That's the Brahmins at the top of the hierarchy. Kshatriya, the Brahmins, of course, as you know, are the priests. The second category, Kshatriya is the warriors. The third is Vaishya. Vaishya meaning merchants, traders. And fourth is Shudra. Shudra is people who do menial jobs, you know, cleaning toilets or sweeping floors, or, you know, butchers and cobblers, those jobs. So you can see from this very distinction that these were based on people's vocation, right? And the priests, of course, because they were people who were educated, Naturally, to be a priest, you had to be educated in the scriptures, and therefore they sat at the top of the hierarchy. And they put everybody else secondary. And therefore, priests, of course, in order to be able to maintain their position of power and influence, needed soldiers, needed warriors. So they put warriors number two. And merchants, because no economy can function without commerce, third, and of course, uneducated, the people doing menial jobs, became the fourth category, the shudras.
So could the children of a lower caste, particularly the fourth one you mentioned, could they do something by education or whatever and grow up into what, a higher caste?
Historically, no. Historically, no, because you were born into a caste. And therefore, you could not change your caste. If you were born a Dalit, a Shudra. Now, as I said, the discrimination based on caste is illegal under the Indian constitution and law. In fact, still, most people would not want their son or daughter to marry someone from a lower caste.
Now, what about a higher caste?
Higher caste is fine.
No, can the lower marry a higher caste?
Yeah, if somebody belonging to a lower caste marries somebody belonging to the upper caste,
they can do that.
They can do that, but even I have noticed that even amongst the lower caste, they don't like marrying into an upper caste. So there are clear boundaries there. But the Indian government has had, since independence, an affirmative action policy where jobs in government, actually a very large proportion of government jobs, are reserved for people belonging to the lower castes. A very large proportion. In fact, now, if you talk to many of the Indian students who come to Australia, and you ask them why are they studying in Australia, why not in India? Quite often, the reason why they have come to study to do a bachelor's degree in engineering or medicine in Australia is because they could not get admission to an engineering college or a medical college in India because of affirmative action policy. If you belong to the upper caste, the entry requirements for you are very high. But if you belong to a lower caste, you can get in with a much lower, you know, academic record. So many middle class, upper caste Indian families complain that their children are being discriminated against for no fault of theirs. You know? But personally, I'm in favor of affirmative action because I think a country like India would need it for at least another 50 years, you know, before you can say that there is some sort of level playing field.
Well, as you can see, we could investigate this question of culture in India in much greater depth than we've had a chance tonight. And thank you very much indeed for giving us the opportunity to get an insight into what's going on there. I've found it, as usual, of these talks absolutely fascinating. One of the things that really came to my... It sort of stuck in my mind was your emphasis on India's relations with China. And it seems to me that this is right at the very guts of the thinking of the Indian government and the Indian people. They're a little bit concerned about what's going on in China. Of course, they're concerned about what's going on in other countries as well. But the thought of China and its growth and its future policies and the still unresolved disputes about the boundaries is something very much preeminent in people's minds. So we're very lucky in Australia, I think, in a way that we're a big island and there's not too many disputes about where the island finishes and where it doesn't. It has been a fascinating night. You talked about that we didn't understand the culture. We do understand something of the culture. We're a little concerned about the cricket, I have to say. And one of the things that concerns us about the cricket is the way that the Indians seem to be taking it over. Not only have they got very, very good players, some of the best, if not the best in the world, and they are at the present time, they also seem to be controlling things in a way which is...
90% of cricket revenue now comes from India.
Yeah.
90%.
I think it's a little bit alarming.
Money talks.
Well, exactly, and you said it. One of the things that is a little concerning is the way they, the cricket authorities seem to have a great deal of influence as to who is going to umpire matches between India and other countries. It's been a terrific night, and we're sending Warnie over there as a an ambassador. I'm not quite sure whether he's going to take his latest lady with him or not, but I'm sure she'd be a great hit over there as she is here.
The lady was actually married to an Indian before meeting him.
Well,
last husband was an Indian.
Right. Well, this is a very discursive vote of thanks. But it's by no means insincere. It's been a wonderful night, and thank you very much indeed for coming along. Would you join me in thanking you?